Will you pray with me, please? Oh God, may the words of my mouth and the meditations of each of our hearts be found acceptable in your sight, O Lord, our rock and our redeemer. Amen. Yesterday, our British sisters and brothers did something that they haven't done in more than 70 years. They marked the coronation of a new king. Now, whatever your thoughts are on the monarchy, the installation of a new leader, be it the coronation of a new king, the inauguration of a new president, the swearing in of a new public official, even the installation of a new pastor, such events are always occasions where people gather and they reflect on where they've been and they wonder about where they might be going. Now, I would be remiss, however, if on Scottish Reformation Sunday, I didn't point out that King George III derisively referred to the American Revolution as the Presbyterian Rebellion. At least 9 signers of the Declaration of Independence were Presbyterians, including one clergyman, the Reverend John Witherspoon, who would later become associated with some minor seminary in Princeton, New Jersey. We Presbyterians are theological descendants of the 16th century Protestant Reformation. And as such, we get nervous when power is concentrated in one person or position, whether it's a monarch or a pope or even a pastor. As heirs of the Protestant Reformation, we believe that sin is not just a list of do's and don'ts or not just an individual problem, but because humans come together in organizations and institutions, human organizations and institutions are prone to sin as well. We recognize and believe that humans, we were created by good, by God, and declared to be good, but we have a sin problem, and so we have a tendency toward idolatry and tyranny. And so in Presbyterian churches, we try to spread power out and monitor it with a system of checks and balances. I tell people who are new to the Presbyterian way of being in the church that I really do believe the Presbyterian way of being, of governing church, is the closest one out there to our American system of representative democracy, and therefore the most maddeningly slow and inefficient. It was a British prime minister, by the way, who once said, "Democracy is the worst form of government except for all the others." Well, our reading this morning is about the inauguration, the arrival of a new king. And our story comes to us from a book of the Bible titled 1 Kings. But before we get to that story, allow me to set the stage with a little visit through some of the political history of ancient Israel. So about 1,000 years before the birth of Jesus, roughly 3,000 years ago, give or take, the people of God took a look around at their neighbors, the Egyptians and the Assyrians and such, and they noticed that their neighboring nations had something that they themselves did not have, namely a king. See, up until that time, the Israelites had lived as 12 tribes, and whenever disputes arose within or between tribes, they appointed judges to settle their troubles, but as of yet, there was no king who ruled over Israel. And so the people of God decided if they were going to be a legitimate nation, if they were going to be taken seriously, well, they better get themselves a king. And so they went to a prophet of God, a man by the name of Samuel, and they said, and this is Ryan's revised paraphrase of a lot of Hebrew, they said, "Hey, Samuel, go tell God we need a king." So Samuel took the people's request before God, and God said, "Oh, Samuel, please tell the people they do not want to mess with a king. They don't need one. All I've ever wanted for you from the day I brought you out of Egypt until now is for me to be your God and you to be my people. Please tell them they don't really want a king." And so Samuel took this back to the people, and you know what the people said? "We want a king." And so back to God, Samuel went, and, And God said, Samuel, think about this with me for a minute. In practical terms, a king will tax you. A king will conscript your sons into his army and take your daughters as his concubine. Trust me, Samuel, a king's a bad idea. So Samuel reported to the people what God had said, and the people listened. And then they looked around at all the other nations and they said, nah, we still want a king. And so Samuel reported back to God, and God said, and again, this is Ryan's paraphrase, God said, all right, fine. But when all this goes sideways, don't say I didn't warn you. So God sent Samuel to anoint the first king over Israel, a man by the name of Saul. Saul was succeeded by a king by the name of David. And under David's rule, ancient Israel began to really look like a legitimate nation. They had a standing army. They had a capital city. David built himself a palace and established the city of Jerusalem as the capital city. And David was succeeded by a king named Solomon. And under Solomon's rule, ancient Israel began to approach the peak of their political and military and economic power. Solomon saw to it that a temple was constructed there in Jerusalem, believed to be the very dwelling place of God on earth. If you've ever visited modern Jerusalem or seen pictures of it, of the Western Wall, or sometimes called the Wailing Wall, that foundation right there, that's the foundation of Solomon's temple. So those combined reigns of Saul to David to Solomon, that spanned roughly 100 years, about a century. But kings have a habit of dying. And by the time King Solomon died, all of that militarism and all of those heavy construction projects had levied a great burden on the people. Now, Saul and David and Solomon, the Bible makes clear they each had their successes, but the Bible also doesn't pull any punches. Because it also names they had terrible moral failures. And because of all of that, the stability of the United Kingdom was beginning to crack and fracture. So Solomon died. And the next king up was Solomon's son, Rehoboam. Rehoboam came to the throne of Israel now about 900 years or so before the birth of Jesus. And Rehoboam, rather, heard a request from a representative of the people named Jeroboam. And he listened to this request and decided, I need some wise counsel. And so he went to two different groups to listen for advice. So that's the setup for our story this morning. So listen now for a word from God. From 1 Kings chapter 12, beginning at the third verse. Jeroboam and all the assembly of Israel came and said to Rehoboam, your father made our yoke heavy. Now therefore lighten the hard service of your father and his heavy yoke that he placed on us, and we will serve you. Rehoboam said to them, go away for 3 days, then come again to me. So the people went away. Then King Rehoboam took counsel with the older men who had attended his father Solomon while he was still alive, saying, how do you advise me to answer this people? They answered him, if you will be a servant to this people today and serve them and speak good words to them when you answer them, then they will be your servants forever. But Rehoboam disregarded the advice that the older men gave him, and he consulted the young men who had grown up with him and now attended him. He said to them, what do you advise that we answer this people who have said to me, lighten the yoke that your father put on us? The young men who had grown up with him said to him, thus you should say to this people who spoke to you, your father made our yoke heavy, but you must lighten it for us. Thus you should say to them, my little finger is thicker than my father's loins. Now, whereas my father laid on you a heavy yoke, I will add to your yoke. My father disciplined you with whips, but I will discipline you with scorpions. So Jeroboam and all the people came to Rehoboam on the third day, as the king had said, come to me again on the third day. The king answered the people harshly. He disregarded the advice that the older men had given him and spoke to them according to the advice of the young men. My father made your yoke heavy, but I will add to your yoke. My father disciplined you with whips, but I will discipline you with scorpions. So the king did not listen to the people, because it was a turn of affairs brought about by the Lord that he might fulfill his word, which the Lord had spoken by Ahijah the Shilonite, Jeroboam son of Nebat. When all Israel saw that the king would not listen to them, the people answered the king, "What share do we have in David? We have no inheritance in the son of Jesse. To your tents, O Israel, look now to your own house, O David." So Israel went away to their tents. But Rehoboam reigned over the Israelites who were living in the towns of Judah. When King Rehoboam sent Adoram, who was taskmaster over the forced labor, all Israel stoned him to death. King Rehoboam then hurriedly mounted his chariot to flee to Jerusalem. So Israel has been in rebellion against the house of David to this day. This is the word of God for the people of God. Thanks be to God. Leadership is hard. Leadership in any level of anything, it's hard, especially as a new leader. It is important to seek out good counsel. And Rehoboam had found some. There's somebody I read, he's not a preacher, but he tells a story about a point in his life when he thought he was going to get rich quick. And so he followed the advice of everybody his age, and he ended up broke. And he said, "You know what I need to do? I need to find the people who have no hair and gray hair and find out how they did it." He received good advice from wise elders. And that wise elders told him, they said, "Rehoboam, do what you can to lift suffering, to alleviate burdens off the people. More importantly, speak good words. Speak good words to them. Show the people whom God has placed under your leadership that you care about them, that you are invested in their well-being." But alas, Rehoboam listened to the young guys. The young guys that were full of hot air and all kinds of other substances that I won't name here. They seemed to say, "Rehoboam, it's good to be king. What's the point of having all this power if you're not going to use it? Lord it over these people. You should be telling them, if they don't quit bellyaching about their burdens, you'll really give them something to cry about. Tell them that when you're done with them, they'll think Solomon was a softy compared to you." And so Rehoboam spoke harsh words and did not listen. Did you hear in the text? That was the beginning of the end. The unified kingdom of Israel began to fracture. And Jeroboam was a spokesman for what so many people were feeling. They said, "What share do we have in this government? If it won't listen to us, what place do we have in it? To your tents, O Israel. Everybody look out for yourself, because the king's not going to look out for us." Jeroboam and others like him, they gave up on the idea. They saw there was no place and no voice for them. And so they left. And from that moment forward, ancient Israel was torn in two. 10 of the 12 tribes going north, calling themselves Israel. The two remaining tribes going south to Judah, retreating to Jerusalem. And it didn't happen overnight. It took a while. But all of that fracturing and cracking, with moral failure after moral failure after moral failure, eventually led to the destruction of both the northern and the southern kingdom. Just as God had warned Samuel, it would so very long ago. But let's talk about you. You, my friend, you are a leader. Maybe you lead a classroom. Maybe you lead a courtroom. Maybe you lead a district. Maybe you lead a family or a team or a business. Maybe your leadership position isn't quite as obvious on the surface, but if you think about it, you are a leader of someone. maybe a younger sibling or a friend. Y'all know, like, the subject of leadership right now is really hot in the literature, right? There are all kinds of podcasts and books and TED Talks about the crisis of leadership we're living through at this moment in the global ethos. One of my favorite definitions of leadership that I really like right now says this: leadership is disappointing people at a rate they can tolerate. But I want you to think with me for a moment about leadership in terms of stewardship. Now, stewardship, some of y'all who know me know I've said this before. When I say the word stewardship out loud from this pulpit, I see y'all grab for your wallet and purse, because we have accidentally trained the people of God that stewardship is just a polite word for money. But biblically understood, theologically understood, stewardship is about so much more than just dollars and cents. Psalm 24, verse 1 says this. It says, "The earth is the Lord's, and all that is in it, the world and those who live in it." So as people of faith, people who take the Bible seriously, we make a theological claim that everything, and I mean everything, and everyone, and I mean everyone, belongs to God. It's all God's. See, Rehoboam, seems to me, his problem was a simple one. He forgot Psalm 24, verse 1. See, he made the mistake. He confused stewardship with ownership. He thought that the Israelite people were his, to do with as he pleased. And he was free to speak to them and treat them however he wanted. It's good to be king. He forgot the biblical truth. They're not his people. They were God's people. And that his leadership was entrusted to him only for a season of time. And so I want you to think with me for a minute, friend, and visualize in your mind's eye the people whom God has entrusted to your leadership. Think with me about your classroom, or your courtroom, or your district. Think with me, visualize your family, your friends, your team, your tribe. Can you see their faces in your mind's eye? They don't belong to you. They're not yours. They're God's. They belong, body and soul, in life and in death, not to you, not even to themselves, but to God. And God has entrusted them to your care, to your leadership, but only for a season of time. One of the best pieces of advice I received from a pastor mentor of mine who had been serving churches for over 30 years. He said, "Ryan, don't forget, we're all temporary." I said, "What?" He said, "We're all temporary. So we're just here for a season." He said, "I don't want to freak you out, but think about this with me. God forbid something tragic were to befall you. If you were a good pastor, your church might have a nice funeral for you." Then the next session meeting, they'd start talking about forming a pastor nominating committee. Right? We are all temporary. We are all here for a season. None of us are irreplaceable. So, my friend, you have a choice about how you will lead. You have a choice. Speak good words. Alleviate suffering where you can. Lift burdens for people. And not just because it makes good political sense, but do it because that's the model of kingship that Jesus sets for all of us. See, one way to think about the person and work of Jesus is to think about the people's demand for a king to Samuel way back when, and think about Jesus as God's answer. In Jesus, God says, "Here's what a good king looks like. Here's what a good king does." And we heard an example in the text that was read already this morning. The night that he knew he was going to be betrayed and arrested, Jesus got up from the dinner table. And he took off his outer garment and he bent down and he washed. Can you imagine how feet are gross, right? He washed their feet. And it shocked them. It scandalized them. Peter was indignant, but Jesus says, no, this is how it has to be. Jesus washed their feet, including the feet of the one he knew would betray him. So that the next day, he's hanging on the cross. And soldiers put a crown on his head. I heard King Charles's crown weighed 5 pounds. Think about the crown they put on Jesus' head, made of thorns. Pontius Pilate, who was the stand-in for the empire, had a notice written on top of Jesus' cross, wrote it in 3 languages so there could be no ambiguity. It said, "The King of the Jews." The message was unmistakable. Jesus is commander-in-chief of legions of angels. With a word, he could have called them down and destroyed everybody who was seeking to do him harm. But instead, as he breathed his last, he said, "Forgive them. Forgive them." This is what a good king does. This is what a king looks like. So we who call ourselves Christians, we who follow Jesus, we believe the testimony of the Gospels that 3 days later after he died, Jesus was raised again, that 40 days later he ascended into heaven. We believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Messiah, the long-promised, long-awaited rightful king, and the one in whom all of human history and human destiny are somehow tied together. There's going to come a day when Jesus returns that we pastors will be out of a job. Thanks be to God. And we give thanks for our governance, but you'll be out of a job too. And thanks be to God. There's a great bumper sticker I saw once that said, "Jesus is coming, look busy." We believe he's coming again. And when he comes, one of Jesus' disciples sees this vision. He says, when Jesus comes, see, there's going to be a great multitude that no one can count from every race and tribe and tongue and nation and people, and they will gather before his throne. We believe that before the throne of God, we'll worship day and night. The one who is seated on the throne, it says in John's vision, will shelter them. The sun will not strike them by day, nor any scorching heat. They will hunger no more and thirst no more, for the Lamb at the center of the throne will be their shepherd. And God himself will wipe every tear from every eye. I look forward to the day we're all out of a job. For soon and very soon, we are going to see the King. Thanks be to God. Amen.